Good morning. My name is David Blair, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. James Waller. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The talk will be rebroadcast on certain local radio stations. Our speaker today is Dr. James Waller, Chair of the Holocaust and Genocide Studies Department at Keene State College, the only such department of its kind in the U.S. James Waller teaches students at Keene State and from around the world to remember how genocide is born from small acts of acquiescence as well as from large acts of hatred, and to remember also how ordinary people, each one of us, can stand against hatred and be a force for healing. He has done important research into the roots of genocide, and he has shared the lessons of this research with students who go forth to work for reconciliation wherever they live. Today, Professor Waller will share his recent work on risk and resilience in Northern Ireland to be published this fall. Please welcome James Waller.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for being here. I didn't know if anyone would show up today, actually, so it's good to have you here. Earlier this week, when I was connecting the dots that I was speaking today and listening to the news about the impending heat wave, I went to my wife for support, and I asked her if she thought the church would be air-conditioned. And she said, "Yes, Jim, I'm sure a church built in the early 19th century and registered as a National Historic Site will have air conditioning." It's just this moment that I'm actually realizing that she was being sarcastic. So thank you for taking the time to be here as well. This week, for the first time since 1951, the British Open Golfing Championship returned to the shores of Northern Ireland. With that has come a series of media reports praising how Northern Ireland has changed since the Troubles, how the Troubles have been left behind, how Northern Ireland has had a flourishing peace process. Commentators have reportedly remarked on how far Northern Ireland has moved in the past 20 years since the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998. Rory McIlroy is Northern Ireland's favorite golfing son, and in speaking of the Troubles, he said, "We're so far past that, and that's a wonderful thing." He went on to say that today in Northern Ireland, no one cares who you are, where you're from, what background you're from. You can have a great life, and it doesn't matter what side of the street you're from. Along with Rory McIlroy, this is a picture of the Northern Ireland we wish it to be today. We want our post-conflict societies to be healed, to be reconciled, to be made whole. That's what we want from societies that have gone through what something like Northern Ireland has gone through. Unfortunately, today I'm going to argue that this hope is more a projection of how we want the world to be rather than a reflection of reality. I'm going to argue that in contemporary Northern Ireland, it does still matter what side of the street you've come from. Northern Ireland, as it is today, is a much more complicated and troubled place than the media has let on this past week. It is, in my view, a high-risk, low-attention situation. And it begs a question for us, and really the focus of today, which is, to what degree does Northern Ireland have hope of recovering from the 30 years of conflict that tore it apart between 1968 and 1998? This question of hope is a common one in Northern Ireland. I spent a semester in 2017 as an honorary visiting research professor at Queen's University in Belfast doing research for this book, collected over 110 hours of interviews from former political prisoners, high-ranking politicians, community leaders, mental health experts, people on the street, But there are two experiences that I'm reminded of that relate to this question of hope. One Saturday, I was in a park in West Belfast. This is a Catholic enclave that at the height of the Troubles, Belfast was the epicenter of the Troubles, and at the height of it, West Belfast was a neighborhood, a community under siege. And I was sitting in a park, just relaxing, watching children play in the playground, thinking of my own children when they were at that age and missing those times with them. And an older woman came down to sit beside me. She was walking a dog, just needed a break. I don't know if she needed a break or the dog needed a break, or maybe it was mutual, but she had a seat beside me. And as often happens in Northern Ireland, when people find out you're not from there, the question quickly turns to, what are you doing here? What brought you here? And especially someone of her age, who had lived through what she lived through in West Belfast for her whole life, is still surprised that people would choose to visit Belfast, that people would choose to visit Northern Ireland. So I explained a little bit of what I was working on. She told me a little bit of what life was like during the Troubles living in West Belfast. And there was a long period of silence. And before she got up to leave, she asked a simple and heartfelt question. And the question was, do you think we have any hope? And that's what she looked at. As someone who survived the Troubles 20 years after, she's still asking that question that brings us here today. Do you think we have any hope? Hope in Northern Ireland is a pretty elusive reality. I think it was the next weekend I was in a Protestant section of Belfast, just a few hundred yards from the Catholic section of West Belfast, and I walked across a garden that was entitled, it was fenced, it was entitled The Garden of Hope and Remembrance. And it was a garden that had been planted in memory of victims of an IRA bombing in that section of Belfast. And I came closer to the garden, I was just curious, and there was a sign on the front gate of the garden, and the sign said, anyone who enters the Garden of Hope and Remembrance, you enter at your own risk. And it was a sign for legal reasons, but I thought the sign had great symbolism, because that's what hope is in Northern Ireland. When you enter into hope, when you try to find hope in Northern Ireland, you enter with that at your own risk, because for many people in the country, it has certainly been an elusive and fragile hope. So what I want to do in my time with you today is unpack a bit about contemporary Northern Ireland, which the present is always past in Northern Ireland, and the past is always present, so some part of that will be history, by looking at three questions. One question is, what was and what is the conflict about? Secondly, when did the conflict begin and end? And thirdly, what's the state of Northern Ireland today in terms of risk and resilience? Because the pressures today for Northern Ireland are pressures internal to the country and also pressures external to the country. So firstly, what is the conflict about? I lost track of how many times I heard this joke in Northern Ireland. So I'm going to share it with you, recognizing that people in Northern Ireland are worn out at telling this joke and having the joke being told, but I think it gets to the heart of what the conflict is about. Two men are sitting in a bar, a pub in Northern Ireland. They're having a pint of Guinness. They're enjoying their time. It's their local pub. Someone comes in who's new. Person that comes in, they don't recognize. In Northern Ireland, when you don't recognize someone, there are a wide variety of cues you can start to try and attend to in terms of how they say certain words, what their name is, what city they're from, what neighborhood they're from. So these two men begin to ply this third man with these questions, and they just can't quite get at it. They can't figure out if he's Protestant, if he's Catholic. And so the questions keep going on and on and on, and finally one of them turns to the new man and he says, just tell us what foot you kick with. Which side are you on? And he says, I'm not Protestant or Catholic, I'm Jewish. And that's unheard, that's relatively unheard of in Northern Ireland because it's a very, very small Jewish community. So then the joke goes on to say, at that point, the two men who are sitting in the bar, there's a period of silence, and then they turn and ask the question, yes, but are you a Protestant Jew or are you a Catholic Jew? And that gets at the heart of it because it tells us that the conflict is not really about religion. That's the shorthand we use for it. If I asked you at the beginning when you came in, what's the heart of the conflict in Northern Ireland? 9 out of 10 people will say Protestant Catholic. But really, Protestant and Catholic have become shortcuts, substitutes we use for the real issue, and the real issue is a constitutional issue. It is a national issue. When the man is asked, are you a Protestant Jew or a Catholic Jew, he is in essence being asked, do you support the union of Northern Ireland with the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland? Or do you support the reunification eventually of Northern Ireland with the Republic of Ireland? So at the heart, the conflict is and always has been this constitutional question. People still identify themselves readily as Protestant and Catholic, but many times they can't tell you the last time they've been to church. It's not that the religious identifier has meaning, it's that the religious identifier has become tied with a national, constitutional identifier, with the majority of Protestants wishing to remain loyal to the union with Great Britain, who see themselves as more British than Irish. So in Northern Ireland, the three terms you typically see are Protestant, Unionist, and Loyalist. Protestant is that shorthand religious signifier. Unionist is the same side, and I think more accurate, which means these are simply people who still wish to preserve the union with the United Kingdom. And Loyalist is typically a term we use for people who advocate violence as a means to that end. On the Catholic side, you have similarly nationalist who would say, we prefer to be reunited with the nation we've been torn apart from, which is the Republic of Ireland. Republicans on the Catholic side are typically nationalists who would prefer to use or who see violence as an option for reclaiming that nationhood. So the heart of the conflict, again, is less about religion, and it's much more about national identity. It's two nations within one state, a British nation and an Irish nation, put together in this artificial state of Northern Ireland. So the second question we'll look at is, when did the conflict begin and end? Depending on who you ask this question of, you can get a wide variety of answers in Northern Ireland. For most Catholics or nationalists, they will say the conflict began 800 years ago with the British occupation of Ireland. Now you start to realize how difficult it is to research and write a book when people tell you that this is a conflict that's been going on for 800 years. And in the minds of many nationalists in Northern Ireland, this is exactly when it started. When British colonizers came and they settled in Ireland and they took the country from the native Irish. Over the course of its history, the northern part of Ireland became particularly contentious in the 1600s, because in the 1600s, British colonial efforts had had fairly good success throughout the island of Ireland, but the north of Ireland, a section of Ireland called Ulster, which included nine counties, had remained really stubbornly Irish. And so by the 1600s, the British recognized the importance of the north of Ireland, of Ulster, as an economic port, and they began to colonize Ulster by the planting of English families and Scottish families in Ulster, with the idea that the planting of Protestants who are loyal to Britain will somehow overwhelm the Catholics who have been less loyal in that region of Ulster. So a lot of Irish history is a fight for independence from Britain. It's been consistent over the years of British occupation in Ireland. It really peaked in the early 1900s with the Easter Uprising of 1916. So by 1921, Britain has on its hands, and I promise the history piece is almost done. So by 1921, Britain has on its hands a problem. It has a country, Ireland, that has 32 counties. It's clear by 1921 that some large part of that country has to be given its freedom, has to be given its independence. And in 1921, an agreement is reached that the 26 counties of the Free State of the south of Ireland will be given independence, but for economic reasons, for national reasons, for all the English and Scots families that had been planted in Ulster, six of the nine counties of Ulster were going to stay with Britain. They were not going to be independent. Why only six of nine? Britain recognized that for Ulster to be managed, it had to have a majority Protestant population. So they looked at the 9 counties of Ulster in the north of Ireland, and they said, if we take all 9, that's too many Catholics. That's almost equal. But if we take just these 6, we've got a heavy Protestant population that should ensure Protestant loyalty to Britain for the next several generations. So in 1921, the north of Ireland became the newest country in the world, the artificial statelet of Northern Ireland, and it became the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. At its birth, as I said earlier, Northern Ireland was 2 nations within 1 state, and it was rigged to be that way. It was gerrymandered to be that way. Still today, throughout Northern Ireland, particularly in nationalist communities, you can see signs and graffiti simply writing 26 plus 6 equals 1. And this is a reference to the counties, that the 26 counties of the Republic of Ireland with the 6 counties of Northern Ireland, that's what should be 1 country in the Republic of Ireland. From its birth in 1921 on, Northern Ireland was plagued by a sectarian divide and plagued by violence from 1921 on, but that violence really began to hit its peak in 1968. In 1968, Catholics in Northern Ireland had become fed up with the violation of their civil rights, the violation of their human rights. There's some debate over how widespread anti-Catholic discrimination was in Northern Ireland, but there's no debate that it existed. There were jobs Catholics could not hold, neighborhoods Catholics could not live in, voting and elections which Catholics were prohibited from participating in some regions, public housing given predominantly to Protestants, not to Catholics. So in 1968, Catholics began to, in the spirit of 1968 that we saw around the world, agitate for their own civil rights and their own human rights. What's important, I think, to understand in 1968, that even Catholic agitators in 68 weren't asking for independence. They were simply asking for the British government to change its behavior. They didn't want the British government out of Northern Ireland. They simply wanted the British government to uphold their civil and human rights. So from 1968 to 1972, and we mark 1968 as the beginning of the Troubles, that really is what the focus of Catholic agitation was about. All of that changed in 1972 in a city by the name of Derry, which Protestants still call Londonderry, Catholics call Derry. And in 1972, on Bloody Sunday, the British government troops responded with force to a nonviolent civil and human rights protest, and in that killed 14 people. I've had the chance to be at the commemoration of the Bloody Sunday massacre for each of the past 4 years. This is a wound still deeply felt by the Catholic community throughout Northern Ireland and particularly in Derry. But what we see after 1972 is that the push for Catholic responses now are less about civil and human rights, it's less about changing the behavior of the British government, and now it becomes about getting rid of the British government, pushing the British government out of Northern Ireland. So from 1972 on, 72 becomes the bloodiest year of what will become the Troubles. We see the renewed strength of the IRA. One of the people I interviewed in Belfast, a lifelong member of the IRA, and he told me in 1969, throughout Northern Ireland, the IRA had a total enrollment of 120 people. He said our artillery in Belfast was 2 pistols and 7 bullets. That's all the IRA had. But after 1972, with the British government's response to what they saw as terrorism, and here we recognize that the state response to terrorism is very often more devastating than the terrorist acts themselves. And in 1972, the British response to terrorism flooded the gates of the IRA with new recruits who recognized that the only solution to the problem was the removal of the British government. The Troubles would continue from 1968 through 1998. They only ended with the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, One of the main brokers of that agreement was Maine Senator George Mitchell, who still is held in very high esteem in Northern Ireland. But by the time the Troubles ended, that 30 years of conflict in a nation of only 1.5 million people, 3,532 people had been killed, over 40,000 more injured. Now, in some ways, 3,532 does not sound like a large death toll, particularly over a 30-year period. But you have to understand, proportionally, if a similar level of violence had occurred in the U.S., the death toll would have been over 500,000. That's more people than we lost in World War II. It's about nine times the number of people we lost in the Vietnam conflict. What's important to understand is that in Northern Ireland, which is still a very small nation, 3,532 people, 40,000 injured. There's still no one today in Northern Ireland that wasn't touched in some way by the Troubles. Everyone I have met during my time there either had a family member or close friend who was maimed in bombings, maimed in a shooting, burnt out of a house, or in many cases, lost their lives. So 3,532, we can't let that number become an abstraction. Every one of those people was someone who loved someone and they were loved by someone else. Someone who had hopes, dreams, and aspirations that would never be fulfilled simply because in most cases, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were at the wrong pub at the wrong time. They were at the wrong fish and chip shop at the wrong time. They were in the city center at the wrong time. And because of that, lost their lives. It bothers me when people talk about Northern Ireland and describe it as a low-intensity conflict. All they're basing that on is the death toll, because typically the standard death toll that we think of when we think of war is 1,000 people in a calendar year. Northern Ireland never fit that. So many times people talk about it as low-intensity conflict, but when you spend time in Northern Ireland, as I have, you realize there was no low intensity to this, because everyone could potentially, possibly, be a victim. Not everyone chose to be part of the conflict, but everyone could be chosen by the conflict as a potential victim. In this regard, it reminds me very often of Argentina. I was just in Argentina leading a seminar last month, and in Argentina from 1976 to 1983, 30,000 people, political opponents, were disappeared. Today in the field of genocide studies, most of us recognize Argentina as a case of genocide, and Argentine courts have recognized their own experience as a case of genocide, but in terms of most genocides, 30,000 people, again, doesn't sound like a lot. But when you spend time in Argentine society and you talk to people from that time period, what they point out to you and what they emphasize is every single one of us thought we could be picked up. We thought someone could inform on us. We thought we could be disappeared. So even though 30,000 doesn't sound like a large number, the possibility, the effect on society was we all thought it could happen to us at any moment. That's the trauma the society lives with. In a similar way, there is that trauma in Northern Ireland for people who lived through the Troubles. It's a 30-year conflict. There's no low-intensity piece about that. This is a generation of a conflict. And even people who survived it recognized that I could have been in a shop on any given day, and it could have been an IRA bomb, it could have been a Protestant loyalist bomb, it could have been the British government opening fire for no reason. I could have been a victim. So our third question is, what is the state of risk and resilience in contemporary Northern Ireland? This has been the focus of much of my work over the past few years. In 2016, I published a book entitled Confronting Evil with Oxford University Press that looked at risk and resilience in terms of genocide, societies at risk for genocide. For me, when I went to Northern Ireland, I had been there numerous times before, because the other large part of what I do in my work is I look at perpetrators of genocide and mass atrocity. So I'd interviewed dozens and dozens of former IRA men, former Protestant loyalist paramilitary prisoners who had taken lives in the Holocaust. But I was struck during my time at Queen's University in 2017 by the recognition that often what the world does, and certainly what we do in the field of intergroup conflict studies, is once the killing stops, we turn our attention elsewhere. I understand that because there are a lot of places in the world that demand our attention because right now there are people, because of their identities, their race, their ethnicity, their gender, their sexual orientation, whatever it be, because of their group identities, they are at risk for victimization, for persecution, even for extermination. So I understand our tendency to want to look to those hot spots, but many times we look away so quickly that we don't realize that the flames of conflict that have been put out still simmer in the coals of intergroup prejudice and discrimination and hostility. And my time in Northern Ireland has convinced me that Northern Ireland is one of those cases where we've turned our attention and things look great and it offers a beautiful golf course that some of us have seen over the past few days. But there are things beneath the surface there that certainly are of concern. So the four things I'd look at, and I'll get to have the chance to do this often. A government will come to me, and I just did this for Burundi last year. Burundi comes and says, we know you have this risk model. Can you write us a briefing paper, a position paper, on what degree of risk you think Burundi is at for conflict or genocide? And the four things I tend to look at are these: conflict history, governance, economic conditions, and what I call social fragmentations. Let me just very quickly go through each of those four to give you a sense of what I see in Northern Ireland today. In terms of conflict history, I think one of the things we recognize is that countries that have been through conflict, that can't be unhappened. That conflict history is there. So how is the history understood? How is the history felt? How is the history remembered by the people in that country? In Northern Ireland, there are significant rates of both individual and cultural trauma. In 2018, a report came out that said the highest rate of PTSD in the world, post-traumatic stress disorder. And think of all the places in the world where you think people would have to live with post-traumatic stress disorder. The highest rate in the world was Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland has terribly high rates of suicide, terribly high rates of alcoholism, increasingly high rates, and only began tracking in 2004, of domestic abuse, abuse of both spouses and children. It's estimated that about 40% of the population experienced some type of traumatic event during the Troubles. And not only were those experienced, but those have been passed on. There are transgenerational and intergenerational effects of trauma that we see throughout Northern Ireland. Just to give you one example, it's probably been 6 years ago now, I was in Northern Ireland for the marching season, which just concluded a week or so ago. And during the marching season, Protestant groups take the streets of Northern Ireland in large numbers with huge bands, fife and drum, all decked out in sashes and bowler hats to celebrate Protestant heritage and to remember the victory of a Protestant king over a Catholic king in 1690. Part of these parades, for some of the parades, they feature a huge lambeg drum. A lambeg drum can be 6 feet in width, and the sound of it is like thunder. And several years ago, I was sitting with a Catholic family in West Belfast, and happened to be holding their six-year-old son was just in my lap. I think we'd been throwing ball or something, and he was sitting in my lap, and we heard the parade coming down on another street. It wasn't even on this street. And he heard the lambeg drum, and I felt the warmth of him urinating, of him soiling himself, just the fear of the drum. He hadn't lived through the Troubles, but he knew what the drum meant. He knew what the statement of the drum was, and I recognized just even in holding him in my lap of my arms that this is part of that transgenerational transmission of trauma, that the memory of the conflict is still so alive and so real in Northern Ireland that even a six-year-old boy in 2010 can't escape it. There's also, in terms of conflict history, you see just a habituation of violence in Northern Ireland, which I think is concerning. in the city center of Belfast. And Belfast has done incredible in terms of increasing tourist activity. It has a beautiful Titanic Museum, a ton of great things going on in Belfast. But in Belfast, the city center shops still close at 6 p.m., except for one night, Thursday night, they stay open to 9. When you ask locals, why do the shops still close at 6 p.m., to a person, they'll say, because during the Troubles, you'd be stupid to shop downtown after 6 p.m., and we just got used to it. It was just the rhythm of life. You close the shops at 6 because no one wants to be out on the streets at nighttime because the risk of being a victim of violence is too great. And there's a habituation to that after 30 years that you still see in the societies. In terms of government, I think there are risks that we're aware of in terms of government. Certainly one of the things we look at is how much do people see their government and their state as legitimate. When we have concern about countries where large numbers of people question the legitimacy of the state in which they live, the legitimacy of their own government, that state legitimacy deficit has always been a big one in Northern Ireland, because today the population is almost half and half Catholic Protestant. And the Catholic side of Northern Ireland has never really understood the state of Northern Ireland to be legitimate. It took me a while in the interviews because I'd be a little slow. But when I'd meet with someone who was a Republican activist from the Catholic side, and I would start to ask questions about Northern Ireland, every time I got this verbal hand slap, because I knew as soon as I said Northern Ireland, I had opened the door for a 15-minute lecture on why it's not Northern Ireland, because they don't recognize the state of Northern Ireland, it's the north of Ireland. So still today, every time I interview someone from the Catholic side, I defer to the north of Ireland, because the general recognition is the state itself we don't see as a legitimate entity. The Northern Ireland government collapsed in 2017. It's still in suspension. Up until that time, the world record for the longest period a country had without a sitting government was 589 days. Northern Ireland has smashed that record. We've never had in history a country without a sitting government for this long a time, from January 2017 on. And to be honest with you, I don't see the government being restored until 2022 at the earliest. That's the next major British election. It doesn't have a sitting government. It's being administered from abroad by Westminster, which again feeds into Catholic perceptions of this is why the state isn't legitimate. It's not even governed by people here. It's governed by people across the sea. And there's also within government, and I understand, and I've written also about the deep divisions within our own country and our own government. And we see every day the way that our government leaders can't even speak with each other. It's horrible. It still is a fraction of what Northern Ireland has had to go through in terms of that identity-based factionalism and polarization. I spoke with one high-ranking Northern Ireland politician who was Catholic. He was from Sinn Féin, the leading Catholic nationalist party. And he said the day he decided in January 2017 that the country could no longer be governed this way was when he stepped into an elevator at Stormont, which is the National Assembly building in Belfast. He stepped into an elevator, and in the elevator were three members of the DUP, the leading Protestant Unionist political party. And as he stepped into the elevator, those three members of the DUP covered their noses as if he stank, and they walked out of the elevator, even though it wasn't their destination. Now, unfortunately, we can probably imagine that type of childish behavior here as well. But for him in Northern Ireland, he said, that's the day I realized we can't govern together. If I can't ride an elevator without someone pretending that I smell and having that type of derogatory response, how in the world can we govern together? And again, since January 2017, they have not been able to govern together. The third risk factor I look at is economic conditions. I think there are reasons of concern as well in terms of economic conditions. There certainly is a lack of what we call macroeconomic stability in Northern Ireland, and this is going to be grossly impacted by Brexit. Northern Ireland did not support Brexit. Neither Protestant or Catholic supported Brexit in large numbers. But Brexit will have its most devastating impact will be on Northern Ireland. And a large part of that will be on the economy of Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland has high rates of unemployment throughout many sectors of its population. This is particularly noticeable in Protestant housing estates, public housing for Protestants. When I visited those housing estates, the leader of the housing authority would typically say, when I asked the question, how many people in this estate are unemployed, it was always at least 75%, sometimes as high as 85%. You have large numbers of people in Northern Ireland, 75, 80, 85% in housing estates, unemployed. I think particularly for Protestant boys, I felt this deeply, there's a tyranny of very low expectation for Protestant young boys and young girls. And because of those low expectations, they really don't see a future for themselves. Because up until just a generation ago, they were assured, particularly the boys, were always assured of having the job their father had in the shipyards, at the dock, or wherever. That's no longer the case. And because of that, Protestantism in Northern Ireland generally has not valued higher education. They didn't need it. They had a job waiting for them because it was their father's job, or their uncle's job, or their brother's job. Those jobs aren't there. And in Protestant communities, higher education is not valued the way it's been valued in Catholic communities in Northern Ireland. And you start to see the weight of that grinding oppression and poverty within those communities. And then finally, in terms of social fragmentation, this is where I see the deepest concerns for contemporary Northern Ireland. It is a deeply divided society. There are peace walls throughout Northern Ireland, some of which run as high as this building. Northern Ireland has 21 miles of peace walls that separate Protestant and Catholic communities. One of my memories I always take is being shown around one of the peace walls by a group of four or five Protestant boys from the neighborhood. This wall had reached about the top of this building, but it had done so in stages. So it used to be an 8-foot wall that separated Protestants from Catholics. And Protestant boys could still lob things over the wall in the Catholic neighborhoods. Petrol bombs, bags of feces, garbage, whatever they could, they'd still lob over the wall. So the city responded by adding another section of the wall to bring it up to 12 feet. And the boys were just beside themselves with being able to explain to me how they figured that out. And they figured out they could get leverage from using a certain kind of toy and make it go over the 12-foot wall. And then went up to 16 feet. And then it had to be raised to 20 feet. And every time it's just trying to outpace the creativity of boys with nothing else to do except how to figure out how to lob things over the wall at their Catholic neighbors. What's striking about these peace walls is that Belfast has said, or actually Northern Ireland Executive has said, all peace walls will be down by 2023. Northern Ireland actually has more peace walls since the Good Friday Agreement than it had before. And I never spoke to a community member or a police officer who wanted the walls down. They all still want the walls up because the walls protect them from the other side. Northern Ireland, Protestants and Catholics have a very exaggerated sense of belonging to their own community. You're one or the other in Northern Ireland. There is no in-between. So even the Jew at the start of our story, a time earlier, he had to make a choice. He still had to be one or the other, Protestant or Catholic. And what this leads to is a constant, and I saw this repeatedly, a hypersensitivity, a constant offense-taking at the slightest thing to cause offense. And I'll say this, and I want to say it in respect because he just passed away 2 months ago, a good friend, Willie Frazier, was a Protestant activist in Belfast. And Willie and I spent many a night together in a pub with pretty significant debates over what a victim was, what a perpetrator was, what justice was. And I respected Willie and his opinion because he had lost four members of his family to the IRA and bombings or assassinations, and he was well recognized as a Protestant activist. But he also was so hypersensitive to slight. And I'll give you one example. In 2012, Willie drove by a primary school, and he saw a flag outside the primary school, and he believed the flag to be the Irish tricolor. So he got on social media, and Willie had an incredibly active social media, and he started just getting tons of things out about, can you believe this school? It's a training ground for the IRA. It's a breeding ground for terrorists. The school has to be shut down, on and on and on. And it was a day later, someone wrote him back and said, Willie, that was an Italian flag outside the school. They were having an Italian cultural event. It wasn't the Irish tricolor. It was off by one stripe. And it just, you know, Willie had to apologize, and he did in his own way, but it's that hypersensitivity. It's just ready to be set off by something, and he was sure it was that Irish tricolor. Over 90% of schools in Northern Ireland today are still segregated by religious identity. When I taught at Queen's University, first day of class, I would generally ask, when was the first time, and these are all Northern Irish students, when was the first time you met someone from the other side, Protestant, Catholic, vice versa? And I'd say generally, 95% of the students in a class said, the first time I met someone from the other side was when I came to school at Queen's University, 19, 20 years of age. They lived their whole life in complete segregation educationally. 93% of schools in Northern Ireland are segregated in such segregation that they had never even met someone from the other side. So finally, what are our concerns? What are my concerns? I look at this, these risk factors, and I worry about triggers. I worry about things that can light this afire. And I think we have a lot of things to worry about. We can worry certainly about Brexit. As I said, it's going to have a devastating impact for Northern Ireland. We can worry about a vote for a united Ireland. That can happen at any time. It only takes 50% of the population plus one to vote for a united Ireland, which means 50% of the population minus one is going to be really angry when that vote happens. We can worry about a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which could be an outcome of Brexit. We could worry about the 2021 centenary, 100th anniversary of Northern Ireland, very happy day for Protestants and Unionists, very unhappy day for Catholics and Nationalists. So with all those things to worry about, I'll go back to the start. Where do we find the hope? The hope is that even though the road to peace since 1998 in Northern Ireland has been a rough one, it's still a road they're traveling. It's still a road they're on. Peace in a post-conflict society is so difficult to pull off. Colombia has had a peace agreement for 3 years between FARC, rebels, and the government. I don't see that peace agreement being in place by September. And it's going to join most peace agreements that tend to fail within 5 years. So the fact that Northern Ireland, 20 years on, is still in a relative state of peace is where we find the hope. And I'll close with this. I was attending a commemoration in Derry where I had the chance, not to interview, it was just a brief chat, with Martin McGuinness, former IRA man, Deputy Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. He'd stepped down because he was suffering from a terminal illness. And I just had about 5 to 6 minutes to chat with Martin after the service. He said to me, Jim, all I can hope is that it wasn't all a waste. And he repeated it. He said, all I can hope is it wasn't all a waste. And when I think of Northern Ireland today, and I think the people there that I love, the country I enjoy, all the wonderful things about the country, you look at it and you say, you hope the peace process hasn't been a waste, because there are certainly internal stressors impacting Northern Ireland, and there are external stressors coming primarily from Brexit that are going to impact Northern Ireland that can take this peace process back, can break it down. And for that to happen to a society that's already suffered 30 years of what Northern Ireland suffered is heartbreaking. So I hope what we've been able to do today is again bring back some attention to a situation that is certainly better than it was, but I think is still a situation at risk. We can't expect 30 years of conflict to be undone with 20 years of non-conflict, 20 years of peace. It will take some time, and Northern Ireland needs that time. And again, in the face of some of the pressures they're looking at with Brexit and other things, that time is going to be hard to find. So thank you very much. I'll look forward now to some questions from you and going from there.
Thank you, Dr. Waller.